I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, the debate over civilian versus military trials for terrorism suspects. But first, as expected today, President Obama announced a new bipartisan panel to take on the federal deficit.
Alan Simpson and Erskine Bowles are taking on the impossible. They're going to try to restore reason to the fiscal debate and come up with answers as co-chairs of the new National Commission on Fiscal Responsibility and Reform.
The president is creating the panel after Congress rejected his request that they do so. Lori Montgomery reports on economic policy for The Washington Post. And so we see, Lori, the panel will be led by former Republican Senator Alan Simpson and former Clinton Chief of Staff Erskine Bowles. And let's start with Simpson, because you spoke to him and you seem to get a sense from him that both sides of the aisle may feel his wrath. What did he say, first of all, about proposed cuts in entitlements, which, you know, Democrats were worried about?
Well, I mean, I think anybody who has taken a look at the nation's budget problems starts with entitlements, because that's where the problem is pretty much starting in around 2020. Things just begin to grow out of control as the baby boomers retire. And Senator Simpson's point was that we have to get away from this idea that people, regardless of income and net worth, are entitled, quote-unquote, to government help in their old age.
And what was his message to fellow Republicans?
His message to fellow Republicans was, get on board or suffer the wrath of the voters. He, like many Republicans who are out of office and concerned about these issues, believes that the party has to cooperate in finding a solution to our impending bankruptcy, or that's a greater political risk. Not helping to solve that problem is a greater political risk than the hit you're going to take for raising taxes.
Well, he's pretty straightforward on it. He said, you know, where were you cutting deficits during the Bush administration? But also, don't get the wrong message from the Massachusetts win of Senator Scott Brown.
That's right. He said that, you know, that was not a glorious victory for Republicans. That was a lot of people who were damned mad about Washington not getting a handle on the nation's problems. But you're right. He also, I mean, Republicans' leadership in Congress to date have resisted this commission, saying, well, the problem is spending and Obama just wants to raise taxes. And Senator Simpson put that right back at the Republicans, saying, hey, you were in charge of Congress for how many years in the early 2000s? You had a Republican in the White House. Did you cut spending? Well, actually, no. You increased spending pretty dramatically.
And this is, again, from a Republican. But what power will he have? A congressional panel would have required action from Congress. This panel, which will have 18 members, as we said, the two chairs, the president will appoint some of the members, and Democratic and Republican leadership expected to appoint 6 commissioners each. But, you know, the Associated Press is writing this commission is going to be a pretty weak substitute for what the president really wanted.
Well, it's not clear that that's true. I mean, for one thing, you've already got an agreement from House Speaker Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Reid to bring whatever this commission can agree on to the floor. The problem with this commission, the bigger problem, I think, is the same problem that existed with the Conrad Gregg Commission, the statutory commission, which is that 14 of the 18 members have to agree in order for there to be recommendations put forward. And in both cases, that requires 2 Republican sitting members of Congress to sign off on a package that is undoubtedly going to include tax increases. And that's where I think the friction is going to come in.
Lori Montgomery, economic policy reporter for The Washington Post, talking about President Obama today announcing his much anticipated and expected creation of a new commission to wrangle with the deficit. Lori, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, when Attorney General Eric Holder first decided late last year to hold the trial for confessed 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in a criminal court in New York and not in a military court, top New York leaders from Mayor Bloomberg to Senator Chuck Schumer supported the idea. Even Rudy Giuliani had long supported criminal trials for terrorism suspects. After 9/11, he said he was in awe of the way the criminal courts convicted terrorists such as shoe bomber Richard Reid and Zakarias Moussaoui, the so-called 20th 9/11 hijacker. But then came this past Christmas Day's plane attack, and critics, including Giuliani, began hammering away at Holder's decision to try that suspect and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in criminal courts. Those concerns helped propel Massachusetts' Scott Brown into his Senate victory.
And the message we need to send in dealing with terrorists, our tax dollars should pay for weapons to stop them and not lawyers to defend them.
Well, now, the idea of civilian trials for terrorism suspects is reportedly on a lifeline, even though some 150 terrorists have been successfully convicted in criminal courts in the U.S. since 2001. We're going to have more on that number, but first, an update from Evan Perez, who covers the Justice Department for The Wall Street Journal. And Evan, the Obama administration is reportedly rethinking a civilian trial for KSM, as he's known. But Republican Senator Lindsey Graham is also trying to force this issue with legislation. Let's start with the Obama administration. What's going on there?
Well, right now, Eric Holder, the Attorney General, was getting beat up so badly with the criticism over this plan that the president has stepped in and decided that he is going to make the final decision. And as President Obama tends to do, he decides that he wants everybody to come in with their best arguments for military commissions, for civilian trials, or for a mix, and for them to present that to him, and then he'll make a decision probably in a couple of weeks. And it's remarkable that it's come to this. I don't think the administration really expected this. They thought that this was a done deal, and unbeknownst to them, behind the scenes, there was a lot of opposition building, and it just burst into public view.
Well, Jane Meyer in The New Yorker writes about the new political advocacy group called Keep America Safe. It was founded by a widow of a 9/11 pilot, conservative writer William Kristol, and Dick Cheney's daughter Elizabeth. They were behind a lot of protests in New York of the KSM trial, and the reported goal is to attack Obama's security plans and vindicate Bush's. But, you know, others point out the White House hasn't pointed out that their policies are almost identical to George Bush's when it comes to these trials. Talk about that, you know, the response to the criticism. Was the Obama administration tone deaf or blindsided, as you said, by a campaign?
Well, I think, you know, it just seems they handled this in such a ham-handed way. I mean, I think even the people inside the White House and the Justice Department would acknowledge they totally misjudged what was happening. And the administration came into office wanting to underscore its change theme. We're different from the Bush administration. And the fact remains, though, they kept, you know, 90% of what the Bush administration's national security apparatus was. So that's one of the things that they kind of boxed themselves in the corner and weren't able to explain to people, look, we're doing a lot of things that the Bush people were doing, simply because they didn't want to admit that.
Well, and that included civilian trials. We're going to talk in a moment with a report that's aggregated just how many civilian terrorism trials there were under the Bush administration in particular. But what has the Obama administration articulated about the law here, about legality? Scott Brown got a lot of traction by saying U.S. courts and laws are meant to protect this country, not our enemies. But what is true about that? What's the legality?
Well, it's a good line to use, and apparently it works in politicking, but it's not based on fact. You know, if you are tried in a military commission, you're provided lawyers, government-paid lawyers, who are defending these detainees. So whether you're in a civilian trial or in a military commission, you will get a lawyer.
And what did the Supreme Court say during the Bush years about early claims that detainees should not be afforded U.S. and international law?
The Supreme Court and all the other courts rejected that argument, and the Bush administration was on the defensive on a lot of these arguments. They had to retreat on all of those.
Well, Jane Meyer also writes in The New Yorker that there are comparisons that the Obama administration could have made. For instance, we remember John Walker Lind, the so-called American Taliban. He pled guilty in a criminal court. He's now serving 20 years in prison. On the other hand, Yasser Hamdi, a Saudi American who was captured the same place and time as Lind was, what was called an enemy combatant, was released and now is in Saudi Arabia. What is the talk within the White House about whether or not they were able to get a message out?
They realized that they mishandled this. You know, you brought up those examples. I mean, the two examples of people who were put into enemy combatant status after they were arrested, Ali Al-Mari and Jose Padilla, the government tried what it could to just basically lock them away and tried to create this new precedent for how to treat these people, and they kept losing in courts, and they finally put them back in the civilian system because they realized they were on a losing streak. So, you know, there's a lot of examples that the administration could have cited to defend its record, and clearly they just couldn't muster much of a defense. And part of it is because, again, they have all these mixed messages. I mean, they want military commissions to sort of assuage the hawks in the country. And on the other hand, they want to be principled or claim that they are principled by defending civilian trials. And it's clear, putting your feet in two different boats, you know, it's very difficult and unstable.
Well, so there's debate going on within the White House right now. Do we have any sense of what might emerge?
Well, the human rights organizations in Washington, liberal groups are behind the scenes. They're doing a lot of lobbying. They realize that this is something that could be lost. And a lot of people I've talked to say that, you know, if Obama retreats on this matter, it will be a huge political blow, probably bigger than even the health care issue that he's had to deal with. A lot of people, the president's supporters, think he's going to end up siding with civilian trials. But at this point, I wouldn't rule out a military commission.
Well, but Lindsey Graham of South Carolina is hoping to force the issue. He wants to address this through legislation. What does Senator Lindsey Graham propose?
Well, he wants to essentially bar funding for these trials to be held in civilian court. He thinks the military commissions are the way to go. And it looked for probably about a week and a half ago, it looked like Graham was gaining a lot of traction for this. And I think the White House got scared and decided to finally sort of jump into action and try to at least stop some of the growing support. And I don't know the prospects right now. It's not very clear.
Well, as you said, Evan Paris, President Obama always supported sort of a mix of military and civilian trials. But is it possible now that we might see, under the Obama administration, fewer civilian trials, far fewer civilian trials of alleged terrorists than we saw during the Bush administration?
You know, it's probably not likely. We're looking at probably 50 or so people at Gitmo who might be slated for some kind of trial. And keep in mind, the administration redid the military commission system, and that hasn't been tested. There haven't been any court challenges that have been heard on that, and that's something that could go on for years.
Well, Evan, we're about to find out exactly how many civilian criminal trials there have been, but you write that even that's become a political football. When the Obama administration points out the number, many Republicans deny it.
Right, exactly. The Bush administration had used a number in the 300 range of how many people have been put on trial. The number is probably closer to 150 if you remove some of the more tangential cases. But even some former Bush officials have tried to accuse the current administration of making up numbers when some of these numbers originated during the last administration.
Reporter Evan Perez, he covers the Justice Department for The Wall Street Journal. Evan, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Okay, let's take a break. And as I said, when we come back, New York University School of Law did a nonpartisan numbers crunch on civilian trials. How many were there? And how well did they work? Well, pretty well, almost a 90% conviction rate. Also later today, the top Marine commander in Afghanistan says U.S. and Afghan forces have taken control of the spine of Marja, the main roads and buildings, but they're still fighting Taliban forces there. Meanwhile, we're going to check in with British troops in another area in Afghanistan. They're fighting for hearts and minds. That's later. We'll also have your thoughts today as well. Who knew how many of you were helping out your town by mowing public lawns? But back in a minute with more on civilian trials for terrorist suspects here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're looking at the debate over whether terrorism suspects should be tried in civilian or military courts. Some conservatives, like Rudy Giuliani, were for criminal courts and are now against them. Karen Greenberg is executive director of the Center on Law and Security at New York University School of Law. The center recently produced a report called Terrorist Trial Report Card. It's on terrorism convictions since 2001. And Karen, confirm for us, has every single person arrested in the U.S. on terrorism charges since 9/11 been tried in a criminal court?
Yes. You'd be surprised at the numbers and how large they are.
Give us some numbers.
The number of cases identified publicly by the Department of Justice as having something to do with terrorism is 828. It's high. And of those, almost 600 have been resolved. Most of them have resulted in convictions. The reason these numbers are so high is that they include an early strategy on the Bush administration, which was, you know, the beginnings of the preventive approach, which looked at things like document fraud, anything they could do to prevent terrorist plots, terrorist cells, etc. over time, the Bush administration stopped using those lesser charges and started focusing on cases that they surveilled, and they started building cases with much more serious charges and successfully bringing these people to trial and convicting them.
These include people like Jose Padilla and...
And these include people like Moussaoui, Richard Reed, the shoe bomber.
Yeah.
And they also include the Fort Dix people, like the Lackawanna people, the big cases that we've heard about. Of all this entire field with serious charges, there have been 174 convictions, and that is the number. And the reason we do this comprehensive study is that we didn't want to bias it at all from the start. So we never had a conclusion in mind. We did it in the Bush administration. We're doing it in the Obama administration.
And just to be clear, has anyone picked up in Afghanistan or Iraq and then sent to either a black prison overseas or to Guantanamo?
No.
Has any one of those suspects ever been tried in a civilian court?
No, but people like them have. In the 90s, and this is what's so interesting about the Giuliani comment, in the 90s, the Southern District of New York tried the embassy bombing in Africa and successfully convicted the terrorists. They are serving, I believe, life terms. They tried the first World Trade Center case. They convicted suspects, and they are serving time, I believe, in Colorado. In all of these cases, declassified evidence has not gotten in the way of being able to present evidence in a way that satisfies both the defense and the prosecution. So, yes, we do know how to do this. But, you know, as you said earlier, there's a political fight going on here. And the facts are very hard to put into play. People are really scared.
Well, let's try to keep doing that, though, because there are also facts about suspects who've gone through a military system. It doesn't seem to fare as well as a civilian system.
The military system has been an unqualified disaster since day one. The track record on convictions at Guantanamo is not good at all. There are a lot of people who would have been tried and convicted in federal courts, given the record. However, there have been three convictions through military commissions. Two of those people are out and free in their countries. One of them is serving a life sentence at Guantanamo currently.
The two that are out are Salim Hamdan. This was the Yemeni who was Osama bin Laden's driver.
Yeah.
He's back in Yemen, out, free. David Hicks, the Australian, who attended an al-Qaeda training camp, is also free and at home. If you hold up the military commissions, even though President Obama says he's improved them, if you hold up those three trials against the civilian trials, boy, it's heavily weighted to success on the civilian side.
Without a doubt. That's why it's so interesting about what the facts are. I think part of it is just not wanting to have to pay attention to this. And if it's in the civilian courts, it's in our face all the time. Whereas if it's in the military commission, it's like it's over there, it's far away. I think there's an idea that these people don't deserve to see the light of day, and we don't have to deal with what's happening here.
But Karen, and again, this is Karen Greenberg, Executive Director of the Center on Law and Security at New York University School of Law. They did sort of an aggregate report taking a look at all the trials of suspected terrorists in the U.S. and found how many civilian trials were successful. Is there something different now? Much more media coverage of any of these events than there might have been in the past, the civilian trials I'm talking about. Do critics have that point that, in fact, they would be, you know, inflated a lot more?
It's hard to say. At this point, yes, but let me give you just a counter argument to that. We are trying a Guantanamo detainee who is among the 14 high-value detainees, which is what we call Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the others. We are trying one of them right now in Manhattan, and nobody notices, and nobody cares. The courtroom is not full.
And who is this?
That guy's name is Gailani. His trial will start in September, but there have been a number of preliminary hearings. He is accused of being part of the embassy bombings that I mentioned before. It's going to be a very interesting trial, but nobody's made any noise about that, and I think it's rather interesting.
Well, they will probably pay attention now, number one. But number two, and somebody would say, but he's not KSM, that there's something distinctly different, you know, from the embassy bombings in Africa to a 9/11 mastermind. But what do you think's going to happen here? It would be your educated guess, but do you think that we're seeing the end of civilian trials?
I think it's possible. I think these are all difficult decisions. The goal is to keep the country safe. And somehow the calculation has been made that Americans will not feel safe trusting in their justice system to do what it always does. to make Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the fears surrounding him affect the criminal justice system the way it is, let's say with Abu Mutallab, the Christmas Day bomber, who is exactly like Richard Reed, who we could convict in these courts, that's what we do, is really, I think, a very sad day. We're losing trust in our institutions.
But is this because the Obama administration didn't make this case?
It's about a lack of clear leadership and wanting to satisfy too many people at the same time. I think that the issue really has to be decided one way or another. And some people are going to be disappointed. And that's the hard decision that the president is going to have to make.
Karen Greenberg, Executive Director of the Center on Law and Security at New York University School of Law. Karen, thanks so much.
No, thank you for having me.
Okay, let's look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll follow the trail of pedophile priests accused of abusing children in Ireland and then shipped off to the U.S. That's tomorrow. The latest news is next, Here and Now. It's day 7 at the Vancouver Olympics, the U.S. topping the medal table after its best day in Winter Games history. 6 wins yesterday, including 3 golds. Shaun White in the halfpipe, Lindsey Vonn in the downhill, and Shawnee Davis in speed skating. Here they are in that order.
I don't think I've been this nervous before at a competition. I definitely was out there with my head a little shaken up just because, you know, it's the Olympics.
When I crossed the finish line, seeing my name up there, number one, was the best feeling of my life. And I've been crying for a long time, and you know, just seeing my family here was overwhelming.
It's my moment. It's my party. You know, like the girl says, she can cry if she wants to. I can party if I want to. It's my party. I can celebrate. I can dance. I can do whatever I want. I earned it.
Sports writer John Powers is in Vancouver, writing for the Boston Globe. John, is the McTwist 1260 of Olympic sports writers. We're so glad you're with us today. Welcome.
Morning. It's morning out here, Robin.
That's right. Well, those golden performances, all of them, they all seemed earned, didn't they?
Absolutely. I think what was interesting yesterday, I mean, and of course, the 6 medals were not only the best day the Americans have ever had, it equals the complete number of medals they got in Calgary in 1988, the last time the Games were here. And they can do it again today, believe it or not.
Well, you know, let's just quick back look. Shaun White with his whatever it was, double McTwist thingy mm-hmm. that he did. That, by the way, every child I know, you are not allowed to try that. But, you know, is it about these Olympians or is it about the other Olympians? I mean, is the U.S. that much better this time around?
Well, I think what they're doing, and they've got the Canadian envy for that, Canada's been called Team Silver up here now, is that they're getting what you might call loose change. They're picking up medals that would be up for grabs, and they're able to get them. The fact is that that White, Vonn, and Davis were all expected to win those events yesterday, but no one expected Julia Mancuso to be second in the downhill. No one expected Chad Hedrick to medal in that event. So this has been the thing, is that they have just been grabbing silvers and bronzes for the whole week here.
But it's also, as we can never forget, an Olympics with a death. And it seems, I mean, I don't think Lindsey Vonn was the only one covering her eyes when she watched those 3 female, you know, competitors and friends of hers fall in the downhill. Is it, we've been saying it seems more dangerous. Is it to you?
No, as a matter of fact, I think this is what people see when they only watch these sports once every 4 years. People crash in the downhill all the time, week in and week out. What makes it a little more spectacular is when they crash coming off a big hill, which is what they have here, on a day like yesterday. Everyone watches the downhill. What made it a bit different is they've been on that hill before in training, but it got icy overnight, and suddenly the whole course changes, and that's what happens with outdoor sport.
Yeah.
Is that the conditions change sometimes from minute to minute.
Well, let's look at tonight. Men's figure skating, we're going to see the Russian Evgeny Plyshenko and the American Evan Lysacek close first and second, respectively, going into the free skate tonight. Your thoughts?
Well, I think the thing for Plyshenko, he is the defending champion, came out of retirement, and he has a quadruple jump that basically most other people cannot match. As a matter of fact, he is a combination, a quadruple triple. And under the new scoring system in figure skating, you get rewarded with huge points for that. And I think that in order for Lysacek to win the gold medal, which no American man has done since Boitano in 88, he has to do everything perfectly to be able to match that.
Well, but you know, I mean, this has been an ongoing debate. Dick Button's weighed in this year on the fact that it's not just the jumps, but the footwork that seems to have made the men look sort of insane when they're skating. I mean, they're just moving so much, and it seems to try to get these points. Your thoughts?
Well, I think one of the criticisms of the scoring system is because everything is now point-based, you see a number of the skaters trying to do the same things. And I know that figure skating purists, you know, kind of bemoan whatever happened to the lovely spins and the footwork. All of that counts. But the fact is that if you hit a quad toe combination jump, it's worth a lot more than most other things. Mm. So the athletes that really want to win gold are going to go where the points are.
And just in the few seconds we have, ice dancing competition begins tomorrow. Two of the three pairs, U.S. pairs, are said to have a shot at medals. What should we look at?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, you've got Merrill Davis and Charlie White are the two-time U.S. champions. Ben Augusto and Tanith Belbin are the reigning Olympic silver medalists. U.S. could get two people on the dance podium for the first time ever.
John Powers of the Boston Globe, we'll be watching along with you. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
And we listen to a little of Rimsky-Korsakov's Scheherazade. We're going to hear that tonight. Evan Lysacek is going to be skating to that. Back in just 30 seconds, here and now. Welcome back. Marines are facing stiff resistance in the Taliban stronghold of Marja. Even as shops reopen and customers line up to buy goods for the first time in nearly a week in the secured northern part of this Afghan town. Meanwhile, British troops operating in another section of Helmand Province have met little resistance. As the BBC's Ian Pannell reports, they are instead waging a battle to win public support.
There is no more poignant moment for a soldier than the eve of battle. A roll call of history.
And with those words, Brigadier James Cowan signalled the start of Operation Mushtarak.
Our aim is not to crush the Taliban, but to win the people.
Using the cover of darkness, hundreds of soldiers flew into the heart of insurgent-held territory. By 5 a.m, we were sat in the middle of a frozen field, listening to our helicopter leave, waiting to see what battle awaited us at first light. The troops moved into the village of Shahid, directed by the whine of metal detectors searching for IEDs.
2-0 up, that's correct, if you push them through.
It soon became clear that the Taliban had chosen not to fight, and the soldiers moved quickly to secure the village and set up camp. So it's been winning hearts and minds rather than fighting the insurgents that's dominated the week. The Taliban used sympathy, intimidation, propaganda and attacks. The troops have strength of numbers, money, and their own version of propaganda.
Can we come in?
Wait. Excuse
my shoes.
2 weeks ago, we visited a cash for works program a few miles to the south. A similar plan will soon get underway in the areas of Operation Mushtarak. Jim Haggerty, the British government's stabilization advisor, explained how it might help to push back the Taliban.
This really is quite a positive counterinsurgency move with other work that we've got planned.
Because it ties people into the development.
It ties people into development progress. And it gives them something to do during the day other than working for the opposition, yeah.
And there's something even more radical being tried, reintegrating some insurgents back into the community. Towards the end of the week, we caught up with Brigadier James Cowan again.
Well, what we always planned was an anticlimax. And what we meant by that was that the enemy would either lay down their arms or they would flee. And that's what's happened here. And today we are going to be handing over a member of the Taliban who was captured back to their community, back to his father, which is a symbolic act of what we call reintegration, but reconciliation, I suppose.
There were kisses and tears as we watched an astonishing piece of political theatre, an insurgent detainee being handed back to his father and his community. So what do the troops make of the last week and their mission? Fusiliers Andrew Compton and Ashley Burgoyne and their lieutenant Stephen Healy have spent the last week on the front line of this operation.
I seen on the news before we deployed, I thought it was going to be like hell, basically. I thought we were just going to be fighting every day. But it's been actually okay at the moment.
In terms of the Taliban, I mean, you've all said it's quiet and we've seen that ourselves. What does your instinct tell you about what's likely to happen?
I think the Taliban obviously see us coming in bulk. They sort of sit off, observe us, and then no doubt they will start contacting us and no doubt we'll be start becoming a lot more kinetic soon.
In between patrols, a group of Afghan soldiers listen to music. None of them are old enough to have known peace in their own country. That is the ultimate objective here. The troops must hold this territory and keep the insurgents at bay. Then they must repeat that in the rest of the south and the east of Afghanistan. It's been a good week for British and Afghan forces, but far more remains to be done than has been accomplished so far in the 9 years since the overthrow of the Taliban.
The BBC's Ian Pannell reporting from Afghanistan. Well, let's take a minute for some of your thoughts. Yesterday, we touched base with mayors across the country to see how they were dealing with budget cuts. Sharon McShirley, mayor of Muncie, Indiana, said she actually thought the belt tightening would make her government more efficient. But her constituent, Lisa Talcott, isn't as hopeful. She writes, as a result of the changes, school funding has been drastically cut. The Tippecanoe School Corporation, for example, may end up cutting up to 150 teachers. We also spoke with Mayor Lionel Rivera of Colorado Springs, Colorado, who said he was asking private citizens to mow public lawns. Well, Deborah Arbees of Concord, North Carolina, wrote to remind us that a lot of states have adopt-a-highway programs. Her dad in Owego, New York, has been mowing an exit off the old Route 17 for years. So we decided to call up 82-year-old Jerry Arbees. Jerry, we know this started with your Kiwanis Club.
We were planning this exit, you know, with flowers and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then I says, you know, we should start mowing this. So finally everybody says, yeah, but who's going to do it? I says, I'll do it for a while. And 12 years later, I'm still doing it. A lot of friends go by and toot their horn, and that's about it.
I understand you also pick up all the garbage that people throw out.
Yeah,
before you,
you can't believe the collection of hubcaps I've got.
Well, what do you think? I mean, some people think, oh, geez, this is disastrous. You know, we don't have enough money in our cities and towns to take care of public lawns. But what do you think about private involvement in that?
Well, I think a lot of people can do this. And there's a lot of people that are retired. They need a little something to do at times.
And now when I go by your exit, I will think fondly of you.
Yeah, it'll be exit 65 by the Treadway Inn.
Okay.
You know, we go here.
Jerry, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
We also heard from William Techue after our Kathy Gunst traveled to one of those shacks on a frozen pond in Maine to try her hand at ice fishing. Now, William is a teacher at Skyline High School in Mesa, Arizona. But, William, you used to ice fish in Wisconsin, and you said you noticed that people are fishing more for their supper than sport, and that inspired what you called some sudden fiction, a quick piece in which the voice of Lake Superior looks up at a fisherman. Can you read a few graphs?
I'd be happy to. You're fishing for your supper. You're thinking the only thing that was true on the news last night is how cold it is this morning. There you go again, staring at your lines, but not watching them. Not really. You're supposed to be bringing home the bacon, or at least the fish, and there you are, hunched over me, worrying whether the economy is going to flip you from the frying pan into the fire. You've already been gutted. Like almost everybody else fishing out here this morning. Well, at least your wallets have been pretty much bled out. But I see in your red, frowning, frosted face that you're hanging on as hard as a weighed anchor. Your wife sees it. Your son sees it. Just because you don't see it so well these days don't mean it ain't there at the bottom of you.
A deep lake speaking up to a fisherman. That's William Techue. His sudden fiction is called Loquacious Lake Superior. We will link you to William's website at oursherenow.org. William, back to class to you, and thanks so much.
I sure appreciate it, Robin.
In his Oscar-nominated role in Invictus as South African rugby captain Francois Pienaar, Matt Damon exhorts his team to hold on for a victory.
Do you hear? Listen to your country. 7 minutes. 7 minutes. Defense, defense, defense. This is it. This is our destiny. Come, Boca!
That performance led to Matt Damon's third Oscar nomination, his first for Best Supporting Actor. And although his character is winning both on the field and on the big screen, here in Oz, pop culture critic Renee Graham is not picking Matt Damon to take home the gold statuette come Oscar night. And she also doesn't think that Penelope Cruz will repeat last year's win for Best Supporting Actress. Renee's in the studio to handicap the race, but also explain what exactly is a supporting performance? Renee, good to see you as always.
Hi, Robin.
And what is it? What is a supporting actor? You refer to something you call the Anne Baxter rule.
There's a few things. What happened in 1950 was Anne Baxter was the title character in All About Eve. She felt it was a lead role, so she campaigned to be nominated for Best Actress, as she was, but she competed against Bette Davis, splitting the vote on Best Actress for that film, and then Judy Holliday won for Born Yesterday. what Anne Baxter didn't realize is that a great supporting role can own the film anyway.
Well, not only that, as you pointed out, it helps if you've got a lot of good actors in one film so you don't split the vote. And I'm thinking maybe that's why Jake Gyllenhaal got a supporting nomination for Brokeback Mountain, even though he doesn't have that much less screen time than Heath Ledger, who was nominated for Best Actor.
It's not to say that one performance was better than the other. It's just a matter of not splitting the vote. It's happened before. It happened with Pulp Fiction with John Travolta and Samuel L. Jackson, but it's not always necessarily screen time. Sometimes it has a lot to do with just what you do with the moment you're there. One of my favorite supporting performances is Beatrice Straight in Network. She's in that film for less than 6 minutes.
Remind us, who was she in that film?
She plays Louise Schumacher, the scorned but still really loving wife of William Holden. And she has a scene when she realizes he's having an affair. And she goes through such a range of emotions in those 6 minutes.
I'm your wife, damn it! And if you can't work up a winter passion for me, the least I require is respect and allegiance. I'm hurt, don't you understand that? I hurt badly.
She won an Oscar for Best Supporting Actress because it's a great role. It's not about the length. It's about what you do with the time.
So who are you looking to win this year? And let's start with the men.
I think Christoph Waltz, who is nominated for Best Supporting Actor for Inglourious Basterds, he's a lock for the award. He's essentially won everything this year for that role as Nazi Colonel Hans Landa.
Now, if one were to determine what attribute the German people share with a beast, it would be the cunning and the predatory instinct of a hawk. But if one were to determine what attributes the Jews share with the beast, it would be that of the rat. If a rat were to walk in here right now as I'm talking, would you greet it with a saucer of your delicious milk?
Probably not.
And that's kind of how I feel about him.
Yeah, he's savage. He's elegant. Murderous malice is his business, and business is good.
Yeah.
And every time he's on screen, it doesn't matter. There are scenes he shares with Brad Pitt in this movie. You're not looking at Brad Pitt. You're looking at Christoph Waltz. He absolutely commands the screen every scene he has.
Okay, well, we mentioned Matt Damon. Woody Harrelson is also nominated for The Messenger. Stanley Tucci for The Killer and The Lovely Bones. And Christopher Plummer, who plays renowned Russian author and philosopher Leo Tolstoy in The Last Station. Now, we have a scene, but we just want to say, if your children are listening, you might want to, just for the next few seconds, say, oh, honey, look, it's something out the window. Here, Christopher Plummer as Tolstoy talking to his protege about an old love affair.
I've never forgotten our time together. Position of our bodies and taste of her.
It was a long, long time ago. Really, you mustn't torture yourself.
Torture? You are a virgin, aren't you?
Well, I try to be. I tried to be.
What? To be a good Tolstoyan? Let me assure you that I'm not a very good Tolstoyan myself. You should think twice before asking my advice on anything.
Now, here's, Renee, one of the most surprising things about this nomination to us. He's 80, and it's his first? Is that possible?
I'm shocked. I found this out a few weeks ago that Christopher Plummer, who a lot of people consider one of the best actors of the post-World War II generation, has never been nominated for an Oscar. Never mind hasn't won one. He's never been nominated until this year. But he's done such films as The Insider, A Beautiful Mind, and hasn't even somehow garnered a nomination, which is really appalling when you think about it. I don't think he's going to win this year, but if there's an upset, I would love to see Christopher Plummer finally get an Academy Award.
Okay, so those are the male nominees for Best Supporting Actor. Let's look at the women, and here we have a situation where you have two actresses from one film in the same category. You have Anna Kendrick and Vera Farmiga from Up in the Air. And you've said that in some cases those actresses can cancel each other out, but that doesn't seem to be what people think is happening in this category this year.
This is not going to be a situation where the actresses cancel each other out. This is Monique's award for her absolutely ferocious performance as the terrible mother in Precious.
This is the film Precious, based on the novel Push by Sapphire.
We're going to hear a scene here where Monique, playing Mary, Precious's mother, is trying to convince the social worker that she is, in fact, a good mother and tries to tell this lovely story about when Precious was born.
Precious. And you need to know that we love Precious and we had dreams. Precious was born around the same time Miss West's son got killed. the summertime. She was born the summertime. Remember? Remember that?
I was born in November.
November.
Good mothers normally know when their daughters are born, so it just sort of this little illustration of some of the issues between mother and daughter here. The remarkable thing, I think, about this really with Monique is that this is a woman who's primarily known as a very sort of bawdy, lowbrow comedian. She's never done dramatic roles before, and this is really as unlikable a character as you could possibly imagine. I mean, she makes, you know, Mommy Dearest look like Mommy of the Year. So, and here she just goes for it. There's no makeup. There's no arrogance. She just puts everything into this role, and she makes this character terrifyingly real.
Well, critics agree with you that she's a clear favorite in that category. That's Monique in the film Precious. Other nominated actresses include Penelope Cruz for Nine. She won last year for Vicky Cristina Barcelona. Maggie Gyllenhaal, Jake Gyllenhaal's sister, nominated for playing the reporter and single mom who falls for Jeff Bridges, country singer in Crazy Heart. We have a scene with her and Jeff Bridges. Let's listen.
Well, you're writing a song on my bed.
So?
So? Every time I lie down and hear that beautiful song, and you're gonna be out there running around, not even remembering this day. I can't even forget.
It's the kind of performance that nominating committees normally overlook because it's very understated, and she plays this sort of deeply wounded woman, but she doesn't spend the movie showing you how deeply wounded she is. It was revealed very slowly and very methodically. I think a lot of people were really, really happy, not just that she was nominated for this performance, but that Maggie Gyllenhaal, who's a really good actress, is getting this kind of recognition finally.
Right. Well, and she also briefly got a song. Let's listen to the song that the character of Jeff Bridges was writing for her. As we say thank you to Here Now's pop culture critic Renee Graham, sort of handicapping and explaining in the best supporting actor categories. Renee, thanks.
Thanks, Robin.
This ain't no place to fall behind. Pick up your crazy heart and give it one more.